Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening and welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network, and on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce, I want to thank you and welcome you to tonight's show. And we have a really interesting lineup of guests. We've got Dennis Campbell, author of many books, including two recently on Tahrir Square. We've got Mahmoud Khalid from Egypt, who's going to talk about his experiences there and what he sees ahead. Also, we've got Emine Dilek, author, journalist, and a women's rights activist international, and from Turkey. And then also we have Tufik Zakaria, who has deep connections to Lebanon and Syria. But first we want to talk about some of the things that are coming up, some events you should know about. First thing we want to talk about is that just yesterday it was reported in the BBC that the 2,000th American soldier died in Afghanistan. Now, it's curious. I spent several hours watching news and here on the mainstream media and never saw mention of it. Certainly never saw mention of the fatalities in Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, of the Afghanistanis or the Iraqis or any of the people who are dying every day, innocent lives taken, on behalf of those who would exploit resources or further their own political goals through the use of weapons. And it's a sad day. It's a sad day for all these countries in turmoil. And I thought it was worth note that we should think just for a moment of all the innocent lives lost, whether they be American or people of any nationality. Every life is precious. Okay. Next, I want to mention that there is a Jamaican Independence Day. Jamaica Independence Day, 50 years later, a lecture by noted author Rachel Manley. This is going to be October 10th at 3 p.m. in the Board of Trustees room at the Administration Building. And this is at FAU, so it's sponsored by the Dorothy E. Schmidt College of Arts and Letters, Ethnic Studies Certificate Program, the English Department, Political Sciences Department, Philosophy Department. For more information, contact Rafael DeLeo. On the 14th, there's a special event, From Invasion to Exploitation. This is going to be in Doral at 41st Street and 97th Avenue, From Invasion by Columbus in 1492 to the Struggles Today in the Tomato Fields of Florida. Peoples of the Americas suffered 520 years of repression while giving themselves in 520 years of resistance. Join us for a work of justice and celebrate our successes. And this is going to be sponsored by Code Pink, Miami and SOA Watch, South Florida. The co-sponsors include Coalition of Immokalee Workers, Code Pink, and Progressive Democrats Miami. For more information, contact Daniela in Spanish at 786-343-3796. And then also, you can call Linda at 305-801-0245, or also Ray at 754-423-0051. Also coming up on the 21st of October is the Space Coast Progressive Alliance Progressive Fest. It's a great meetup with lots of tables and information. There's going to be medical screenings, all kinds of good information. Join up. There'll be lots and lots of progressives from across the state. For more information, call Mike at 727. Oh, wait, that's another one. Contact the Space Coast Alliance. Look for their website online. Great information, great people. You should definitely be there. And then finally, this was about Mike Fox of Progressive Democrats of America. They're doing phone calls. They're trying to support Alan Grayson and many other progressive Democrats. So if you can help, just make phone calls. That's all they're asking. Just help make phone calls. Call Mike at 727-320-4502. We'll have some more announcements later. So stick around, my friends. There'll be more to come. Now, also, in the news, we have some very interesting environmental news we want to mention. The Bayou-Corn sinkhole is expanding, and it's not only expanding, but there's not only oil being seen there and tested there, but they're also finding radiation. Bayou-Corn sinkhole evacuee Henry Boudreau has gone from a retirement home for so long, he's said it's beginning to mildew. He said he's frustrated following a Saturday morning community meeting where he and other residents were briefed at the St. Joseph Worker Catholic Church Fellowship on the latest sinkhole developments. Boudreau and about 200 other residents, many of whom were forced to evacuate from their homes August 3rd. Apparently, the collapses continue, and now it's a four-acre sinkhole. And also, there's more information can be found through our good friends and fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. Also, Colleen Rowley has an excellent article in the Op-Ed News about the evolution of the terrorists who we used to fund, first to fight the Soviets, and then those same monies and resources have come back, of course, to bite us. And also in additional exciting news for our friends in Japan, there is a large typhoon expected to run right smack over Fukushima, and we know how tender and delicate so many of those buildings are at this point, including exposed fuel pools. So unfortunately, there's probably not going to be much good news there. And they've been finding continued higher and higher levels of radiation detected in the water off the coast. And a story in Energy News entitled Offshore Radiation, Marine Snow Like Green Starlight. A surprising result was reported by the Ocean Investigation Team. 1,200 becquerels of CS-134 were detected in marine snow fathered from the deep sea. Radioactive contamination has reached the deep sea, which is 2,000 kilometers distant from Fukushima. And it's unfortunately, the hits just keep on coming. Their prime minister has suggested they need to wean themselves from electric power. And it is not good news there in Fukushima. Okay. We've got our first guest. Let me see if we've got Dennis there. Dennis, are you here?
Good evening, Rick. I'm here.
Great. Welcome. This is Dennis Campbell, author and recently of two books on Tahrir Square, a great progressive journalist that publishes UK Progressive. Dennis, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, sir. And you?
I'm doing well. We've got this Middle East peace discussion tonight. And one of the things I wanted to do was, you know, unfortunately, we're in the heat of the political season here, and they're talking about all kinds of things that no one's talking about, the fact that we've got all these wars going on in the Middle East. And not only are these wars our wars, but they're also wars that impact thousands and thousands of innocent lives. The area is in turmoil. We've got changes of government. We've got the Syrian situation, Egyptian situation. Sir, what can you tell us? What's your perspective these days?
Well, you're essentially trying to reverse 100 years of colonial dominance throughout that entire region. You know, if you look at the U.S., you look at the U.K., you look at several other European powers, this region of the world has been one where pretty much the imperialism has run roughshod over what was there before. In that regard, you end up with puppet dictatorships installed to keep the relative peace. But unfortunately, once you have that peace, you need to keep it under the thumbnail of some pretty dominant and ugly people. So you create an environment where a Hosni Mubarak, where a Saddam Hussein, where a Shah of Iran to be replaced by a clerical regime, very brutal dictators can come in and pretty much take over and do as they wish. And what we've seen over the last 2 years now, or well, 19 months, is the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. They have now reached a point where a number of governments have fallen, a number of governments are in the process of falling, and the simple fact that the United States and several other countries have been very slow off the mark to support them has caused numerous problems for them. We want democracy in the region, but only if those that are in charge of those democracies are people that we find acceptable, and that, of course, doesn't work. So you have a number of very fragile new governmental relationships, and the point I always make in Twitter and in discussions and in interviews is that, you know, from the moment of the Egyptian revolution, which ended with the resignation of Hosni Mubarak on the 11th of February, we entered a period of great uncertainty because it took even the United States 11 years after the 1776 Declaration of Independence to come up with a constitution and a stable form of government. So for us to expect after 18 months in a region that has not known democracy for 7,000 years that everything would be hunky-dory and ready to roll is a little bit absurd. There are going to be a lot of regional, factional, long-time suppressed peoples that are now going to be demanding their place at the table, and we are seeing that across the entire region.
Well, it seems to me that we have in large part complicated the issue because, of course, we back these regimes. We have mud on our hands. We have blood on our hands. And in fact, a lot of these regimes with their very repressive and tyrannical forms of regime have served our purposes. You know, we sent people to be tortured in Syria. We used Egypt to do some dirty business for us. America, unfortunately, doesn't have clean hands. So when people make out that this is all about a film, for example, in some of the recent fracases, it seems to me that they really just don't know what the heck's going on.
Well, yeah, there is a certain amount of that, Rick, and I think the the broader issue is that we cannot seem to come to a determination of what side we want to be on. You know, on the one hand, we fund the Egyptian government $1.3 billion in aid, which goes via the Pentagon and arms sales to maintain the military. But the military is, you know, having its difficulties internally with the election of the Muslim Brotherhood as the predominant party in the parliament. You had the equivalent of a judicial coup, basically the Supreme Court saying the parliament was not recognized, and you have a complete mess at this point because you've not had anybody sitting down to draft a constitution in that country, yet everybody claims they're in charge and in control. Human rights are pretty much being thrown out the door because the secret police are back, the military are in control, and that's just in Egypt. If you go a little bit further to the north, up into Syria, you have a situation that is a humanitarian tragedy, and there's no way it's going to be resolved anytime quickly. So you've got all of these issues competing with each other, and no real idea of what the resolution is going to look like. And the one thing that the United States and European governments cannot stand is uncertainty, because wherever there is a vacuum, there is a huge fear that there will be some sort of a radicalized government that will come in and take over, and they will not have what they've always had, which is control. So it becomes a very difficult situation.
Well, also, it seems that there are so many competing interests. You've got, obviously, the native population with a variety of different political and tribal interests. You've got Islamic interests. You've got financial development interests. You've got military interests. In Syria, where you know the government is being pulled in so many different directions, and the question is who's supporting these rebels? What factional interests do they represent? And of course, you know, the West is trying to ease Assad, it seems, into some other an easy exit. But unfortunately, what's going to be left behind is going to be a real quite a bizarre fix, and there's no existing pathway to a stable government, unfortunately.
Well, that's always been the issue. Whenever if you look at Syria, you have the so-called Western interests with the United States and Europe on one side, you have the oil and investment interests of Russia and China on the other side. And then you have the neighborhood bully and troublemaker, Iran, supplying arms and all sorts of other issues on the third side. And this is not unlike a situation I covered for a number of years over in Iraq, where a group of Iranian insurgents called the MEK, who just came off of the terror watch list in the U.S. a week ago, were also similarly being attacked by the Iranians, attacked by the Iraqis. Nobody wanted them there when the U.S. troops were protecting Iraq, supposedly, during 2003. They and the U.N. protected the refugee camp of 3,400 people where they were housed, but all of it got thrown up in the air when the SOFA came in, the Status of Forces Agreement, which basically said to all American troops they had to go back to their bases. And these people were sitting ducks. They had no UN protections. And basically, it's a metaphor for the entire region. You have so many people that are pulling on different pieces and parts in so many different directions. Even within a country like Iraq, like others, you have the continual battle between Sunni and Shia forms of Muslim. You have the potential for groups such as Al-Qaeda and the Taliban to come in. And you also have, problems with maintaining the peace in a nation like Syria, because if the people come and join in the uprising, then who is in control becomes a major issue moving forward.
Yeah, it is, and you have to feel sorry for the vast bulk of people who don't really have a particular axe to grind, who aren't really, committed partisans to any one particular party, and yet, innocent lives are being lost every day. I recently heard a comment by one of the leading lights of the UN who turned to Tony Blair and said, you could have prevented that Iraqi war if he'd stood up. But he didn't.
Well, that's a third issue. I mean, if you want to, the Iraq war, could very easily have been avoided had they stood up to George W. Bush and the neocons and said, no, this doesn't make any sense. But that's very difficult for any UK government to stand up. I mean, if you look at the loss of troops and treasure and commitment, I think it's something like 8% of the troops come out of the United Kingdom, whereas 90% of them come out of the United States, and then the rest of the allies make up the remaining 2%. So there's always a calculation here in Europe that says, yes, we agree with you and we'll support you just as long as we don't have to send troops. And that, I think, is also another issue.
Well, one of the other things I want you to keep in your mind, because we've got some other guests to bring on, one of the other issues that I want to make sure we address is nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. And we'll get to that as part of our discussions at the roundtable. But let me welcome another guest. Thank you so much for those introductory comments, Dennis. And I'll ask you to wait here on the side, and I'll bring on another guest. Thank you, sir.
No problem.
Good evening.
Hello?
Hello there. This is Rick Spezak. Is this Emily?
Yes, yes. Hi, Rick.
Hello there, my dear. You're just
Can you hear me well because I'm on my phone?
You sound wonderful.
Okay.
It's great to hear your voice. Why don't you go ahead and talk to us a little bit about the work that you're doing. Do I understand your heritage is Turkish?
Correct. I wanted to correct one thing before I say anything, because
sure.
The Egypt Square for the Egyptian people where they meet, like it's our Times Square, is called Tahrir, which is T-A-H-R-I-R. And I believe, I don't speak Arabic, but I believe it means either Liberation Square or Freedom Square. And my son's name is Tahir, which is T-A-H-I-R. And I think you've been calling the square Tahir. And I said, I'm going to just correct this first before I
Thank
do anything.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to mention two things. I do not practice Islam myself. I don't consider myself a Muslim person.
Uh-huh.
But I have family and friends. You know, most of my family are Muslims. You know, I grew up in Turkey and moved to the United States in 1993. And I wanted to mention something that I think it's not being talked too much on U.S. media, and I find it to be very important.
Good.
About the portrayal of Muslims in general on U.S.
Sure.
media, both liberal and conservative, and also Hollywood. I think what I'm seeing is after what happened with the in Libya, you know, Benghazi, our ambassadors were killed,
yeah.
And there was this really very negative backlash, again, just like what happened after 9/11. And we need to understand that, I mean, I'm not condoning killing innocent people in any
sure.
way or shape.
Sure.
But there, according to reports between an organization that is called Avaz, A-V-A-A-Z, and Gawker, early estimates that put those participation in anti-film protests, those people that were killing and, you know, on the streets burning American flags, they're about 0.007% of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. So it's a very tiny fraction of those, you know, who marched for democracy in Arab Spring. And I also want to mention that after the attack in Benghazi, ordinary people turned out on the streets. In Benghazi, in Tripoli, with signs, many of them in English, apologizing and saying the violence didn't represent them or their religion. 10 Libyan soldiers, if I'm not mistaken, were killed trying to protect our diplomats. So none of these things are being mentioned on U.S. media, both sides. And, you know, I can understand the conservative bias, but, you know, like Fox News, I wouldn't expect them to cover it. But I don't really see a lot of emphasis on that on the liberal side or even more, you know, moderate, I want to say like CNN or mainstream media. So I think this is one thing maybe we need to really focus on and understand that, you know, every country have their extremists and fundamentalists. And we need to be more sensitive and careful, I guess, what I want to say, when we're portraying in general. And not all Arabs are Muslims. Not all Muslims are Arabs. Most of Muslims' population actually are located in India, Indonesia, and Malaysia, you know, over 200 million people,
mm-hmm.
and they're not Arabs. So I think that there has to be some education on our part as well as journalists, you know, that work in U.S., to
sure.
maybe bring more awareness to this part. I wanted to mention that first. And did you have a question for me?
Well, I wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about the fact that with the turmoil of Arab Spring impacting so many countries over there, I was wondering with Turkey having an Islamic government, but not a very conservative one, not conservative. I don't want to characterize any more than that. I was wondering, what do you hear from family back there in Turkey about how this looks to them? I'm sure that there's, you know, quite a bit of discussion about the choices, let's say, being made in Egypt, or the choices that are being approached anyway in Syria. The discussions of the ongoing turmoil. You know, there were a few neocons, I suppose, that thought they could go into Iraq or go into Afghanistan establish some troops and then just go take whatever they wanted, and that everything would be fine and they could just leave. Well, that's so far from the case. It's left nothing but a huge unstable region. And I was wondering what kind of conversations you hear from family back in Turkey.
Well, I think Turkey has its own internal domestic problems they're struggling with between their conservatives and their liberals, which I find it very parallel to what's happening here between us, between, you know, Democrats and the Green Party and the,
sure,
and the conservatives, GOP. It's very similar to that, the dynamic. Currently, I, as a liberal, and most of my friends and family are as well, more, I want to say, what they call it, the elite, the smart people. So they're, of course, not very happy with what Erdogan's regime is trying to do currently in the country. They're much more conservatives, and then the, you know, women's rights are, they in their minds are thinking women's rights are being more deteriorating. And also there are a lot of journalists and students and army generals are jailed. They're in prison right now, and they're being held without due process of trial. So this is a little bit concerning. I would like more human rights organizations to focus on it and look into it, because I think the civil rights of free speech and the freedom of press is being, you know, marginalized and oppressed right now. So those are the issues Turkey is dealing with right now. And, of course, we have over, if I'm not mistaken, over 200,000 refugees from Syria because of the issues of Syria. They're placed in temporary housing or temporary tents. I think they have refugee camps along the border, southern border of the country. So that is, I am sure financially, economically is a little bit of a burden on the country, but Turkey's economy is, interestingly enough, doing well. So the economy is not the biggest problem, but more are the social issues.
I was looking at Al Jazeera this morning, and it made a comment from the Turkish premier saying that the era of military coups is over. And I thought that that was probably an interesting thing to say. I suppose that that means that some things were resolved with the military.
Actually, the dynamics in the country is very interesting, because that's why I always say it's better to speak with the people that live there, the actual citizens of the country, then assume what we think we know about each country, because the military traditionally has been the bastion or the force of secularism in the country. Military, interestingly enough, has been more liberal, more not very the conservative side of the country. So conservatives, the current regime, didn't want them to basically take over in a coup, which I understand, and nobody wants a coup, which it's not healthy for the democracy. But as we see the country going towards more of an Islamic traditional government, that's also very concerning for the people of the country. So I'm hoping that instead of jailing or prisoning the generals or the representative of the military, they will find a more better solutions to it. So that's the problem.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anything you can say about things you may have heard of this from the Syrian refugees?
Syrian refugees, I mean, they're in bad shape. The only thing is they really don't know who is coming and going. I think there are problems with the different people, different fractions coming through from the border, because in order to help them, of course, they're trying to keep the border more open. And that is causing some troubles, because I think the locals and the security forces around the region are concerned about possible Al-Qaeda or other extremist groups coming through from,
mm-hmm.
you know, through the refugee camps. So that is one concern. But, of course, you don't want to stay in a refugee camp. I mean, it is, I am sure, as much as the, you know, Turkey is trying to help them, whatever they're providing, food and water, I am sure it's miserable. It is not a place to for any children or any families to be there for months and months. So I am hoping that it will be resolved soon, but that's it's very confusing and difficult times for, I think, both countries.
Well, I thank you so much for that insight. If you'd stay on the side, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring on my next guest, and when we have the full panel, we'll start the roundtable discussion. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, great. Let me bring on my next guest. Good evening.
Hello?
Is this Mood?
Yes, this is me. How are you? How are you doing?
Very good, sir. Very good. I'm so glad you could join us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Mood is a fine gentleman, a very accomplished graphics artist and designer, and he has moved to this country from Egypt. Mood, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your life and what brought you to the States?
I'm a graphic designer. I came to the state for living. All my family lives here for many, many years, and definitely looking for a better life. I want to talk about the revolution in Egypt. That's what one of the greatest things happened in 2011. And it starts small and got bigger and bigger and bigger. It was organized from the youth in the street. They're trying to make a better life in their own country, and they've been trying left and right, and they couldn't do anything for themselves, for their families. So came to that moment, and everybody went out in the street and have all this courage to do what they did. It started small, as I said, and it started bigger and bigger. And after that, Muslim Brotherhood stole the evolution from the youth, and they took over. It was a very hard time for everybody who lived in Egypt at that moment. Everybody suffered. All the people stayed from the sunset to sunrise to protect their properties because of the thief, the people killing, kidnapping. It was a mess, and no police in the streets, and no internet, no connections. And it really was a very hard time for everybody. And a lot of people said, just like whatever happened in 1973, the war between Egypt and Israel, is way better than what's happened at these days. And in the last election was so weird. It's like a Muslim Brotherhood bought people votes by a bag of sugar and for rice, and just to make a living, because people, they have no knowledge, just only they're trying to make a living, and whatever who gives them some food, they will go for them. And that's what happened. And some of the things that's really I noticed in American media, that every time they talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, they said Brotherhood, and they don't mention the name, the original name in Arabic language. It's Muslim Brotherhood, and it's not Brotherhood. So this is some of the things, and people talk about it in the streets. People in Egypt said that Obama was behind on the election in Egypt, and Obama helped them to get into the power and do all these things. And it was really, it's not nice to have countries in power controlling other countries, and it really wasn't in our benefit. I'm talking about the people in Egypt for sure. It wasn't safe, it wasn't good, stock market is down, no police anywhere. It's like it was a big mystery, no electricity, no water. People suffering everywhere, and even when we got the new president, he promised a lot of promises, and we didn't see anything shows yet, and just like a talk and talk and talk, but we didn't see anything actually happen. And I don't know what's going to happen in the few years, or I don't know, it's going to be a few days or a few years, nobody knows. But I wish that everything will be good. I love my country very much. It's one of the greatest country, and I recommend that everybody can get the chance to visit Egypt. And I wish that everybody can pray for the country, pray for the president, to give him the wisdom to direct this country in the right direction.
Mood, let me ask you a question. Is the has the situation stabilized? Is power getting more normalized? Are there police back on the streets, or is it still very unsettled?
What they say is different than the actual. As they said, yes, police on the street, but people still being kidnapped. People still being killed. When a fight starts in the street, you see guns, you see swords, you see knives. So it's not really safe at all. And it's not safe after sunset when you walk in the street. It's not really safe at all, especially for the women. Women and girls can be kidnapped so easily.
Let me ask you one more question. You know, many people, while on the one hand they were very happy that the tyrant Mubarak has been disposed, other people were concerned that the Islamic influence would be so strong that minority religions would be threatened. And we hear stories continuously in the Middle East about religious crimes or people being charged with blasphemy. Are you hearing stories of religious friction increasing in Egypt?
Yeah, this has been happening many years. Even with Mubarak time, it's happening on I don't want to say a daily basis, but it's happening every week, every month. Something happens, and like all the Christians in Egypt suffering from all these things, and that's why you see a lot of Christians trying to move to Europe, to America, to Australia, to go somewhere else other than Egypt, because it's very hard to live, to make a living over there.
I see. Your family, I understand, is not Muslim. And when you were growing up as a young man, as a young boy, was there discrimination in your childhood since you were not part of the majority religion?
For me especially, not at all. But I saw that everywhere. I heard about it a lot of times. So it's something happened. Since when I was a child, I hear about all these stuff, and I see it. So it's kind of, it's not really a safe place. But before that, it was less than what's happening right now. Like in Mubarak time, it was more safer than nowadays.
Well, let me ask you one final question before we start the roundtable going on.
Sure.
I know you studied quite a bit in Europe. You studied, do I remember correctly, in France and Germany, or was it just Germany?
Germany.
Did you see, how were Muslims treated in Germany when you were studying there? Was there much friction?
No. It's very well, and I remember there were a big part of Turkish people live in Germany, and they go to mosques, they do their prayers, they do everything, and everything is so good and fine with them. I didn't see any problems happen.
I'm going to have to disagree with Mahmoud on that, because I know there are about 4 million Turks that live in Germany, and I know that they have been through a lot of discrimination, and including their houses being burned, and they're burned alive in their own homes, kids and parents. So to say that they're treated perfectly, I don't think it's proper. And I think it's also not very fair to compare Germany to Egypt. They're very different countries. Germany is considered a developed, modern European country, so we should expect better treatment of minorities in so-called developed countries, I think, than Egypt. And I also want to mention something about Mahmoud mentioned that President Obama helping Muslim Brotherhood. This is, I'm really not sure about that. I don't think we should really say things like that unless they have some sort of proof, because the help that goes to Egypt, about that $1.3 billion Denise was mentioning, that is from the Camp David Accords from 1970s. That was arranged between Egypt and Israel, so both countries receive aid through to keep the peace between them. So in a way, kind of like a bribe, I would say. But that's not, I mean, exactly, not to, you know, keep them, preventing them from attacking Israel. So it is not really to say that aid didn't stop. So they're still going, that aid still goes to Egypt, but the people actually, the Egyptian people elected their government currently. So that aid goes to whoever is the government right now. It's not, so this is not something we can pick and choose. What we can do is we can elect to stop the aid, but to say that President Obama is helping Muslim Brotherhood is just, I think we need to be very careful before we say things like that.
You run the risk of this becoming a Fox talking point, and I don't think that's where you want to be.
Sure. And I think it's entirely possible that one person's experience in a country might be different than another. But let me ask you all to wait a moment, and let me bring on my last guest. And this is Tufik from Miami with Lebanese heritage and connections. Tufik, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you could
join
us.
Thank you for having me on air.
Tufik, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then work that into what you hear from back overseas.
Well, my name is Tufik Zakaria. I was born to a Palestinian father and an American Lebanese mother. I was born in Beirut. I've lived there through my childhood. I still have family there. I go back quite often. And I've been living here in Miami for 20 years. And I'm also an activist here in the community in South Florida. And I'm part of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, South Florida chapter.
You've been studying governmental affairs, haven't you?
Public administration,
I'm sorry.
And then my undergrad, I had a Middle East Studies certificate from Florida International University, with an undergrad in political science.
Well, excellent. What are you hearing from back home?
Well, it depends who you ask. One segment of the community is doing quite fine. One other segment of the community is not. As it relates to the Syrian conflict, of course, you have different viewpoints. It all depends on what agenda you follow and whom do you believe, and what TV station you follow.
Well, let me ask you this. Your Lebanese family, how much impact is there from the Syrian problems in Lebanon?
Well, my side of the family has not been negatively impacted. Actually, as a result of the Syrians that have been moving back to Lebanon because of the conflict, it's actually benefited hotels, benefited restaurants, it's benefited the service industry because people who have money go to Lebanon. And even the people who don't have money, but they usually stay in different parts of the country where it's poorer, and typically the United Nations takes care of them, or Muslim organizations, specifically Sunni Muslim organizations, takes care of them. But my family they're middle class, we'd say, but they're doing okay. My cousin used to be a distributor for the Syrian market until the conflict started. And his line was primarily Oakley sunglasses and high end stuff for the well off of Syria. So of course he's somewhat impacted, but he has different markets. But I can tell you there's other people who are Italians who are, they're not family related, but friends, friends of friends, and they've been hurting.
I guess. For people who are much closer to the Syrian situation, you know, you're a man with experience in these countries as well as experience here. You study public administration. You know, what path might be found to some kind of stabilized government when you've got these, you know, you've got a crumbling dictatorship on the one hand, you've got religious forces on another, you got tribal issues on a third, you've got obviously international power brokers, the Russian-China agenda might be different than the Western agenda. I mean, how might one work to find a path to some kind of stable governance? Do you have any insight to that? I mean, obviously, I don't expect you to pull a Band-Aid out of your pocket, but as someone who thinks about public administration, you know, what kind of reaction do you have to that issue?
Well, there are two ways of negotiating a conflict. One is through power, arms, when one realizes that the other one has the military means, or through two external forces, and they pressure the Syrian regime to step aside and create a consensus government based on different factions, different groups, religious groups, ethnic groups, whether it's the Arab or the Kurds or the Armenians, or the Sunnis or Alawites or Christians as well. So there are two ways, and right now no one's agreeing to stop the bombardment of Syria. And then neither China or Russia or the EU or America is willing to concede defeat. So what's happening right now, from how I see it, is going down the line of Afghanistan, unfortunately, where you have the Syrian regime fighting against not just Syrian rebels, but foreign jihadists who have come from, as Christian Science Monitor reported, from Turkey, from Afghanistan, from Saudi, from Qatar, and other parts in Chechnya, for example. So these are the problems, and there were a lot of people who were on the side of the protesters initially, and whether these rebels get support from the local community, I don't know. I can't give you. I don't know that information.
Okay, let me open up to the whole group now. And one of the first questions I want to ask you is, you know, Americans have heard, with their limited cultural sensitivity and their limited experience in the geographical area, they've heard for the first time for the last maybe couple of months about the Alawite faction. Now, we've heard about, you know, the Sunnis, we've heard about the Shia, we haven't heard too much about the Alawites. And if I could start with you, Dennis, and have each of you kind of comment, what can you tell us so that we all understand this situation better? Dennis, you have a comment about the Alawites?
Well, you know, they're a Syrian group mostly, and their focus is mostly on the mystical. They're somewhat of a religious group that's been following a branch of Shia Islam. Beyond that, I don't know very much about very specifically how they operate or where they operate, only it's just another group of people thrown into the mix. You've got so many different factions of the Muslim religion, the Islamic religion, that are in a state of eternal conflict with each other, because there's just a simple disbelief between the various factions. And, you know, they have some power in Syria, but they are becoming a factor only because the government is beginning to recede. It's beginning to fall into chaos. When you start talking most of the nations across that region of the world, you have a lot of what would be considered more tribal relationships. If you look at a country like Libya, for example, part of the problems that we talked about in Benghazi and Tripoli are because you have completely different tribal organizations and relationships that have been warring for centuries. And, you know, throughout the entire Middle East, up even into Persia, you're going to have different groups that are going to be constantly battling with each other.
Thank you, Dennis. Maud, sir, do you want to make a comment on the Alawites?
No, I don't have any much idea knowledge about that.
No problem, sir. Emini?
Can you hear me well because I put you guys on speakerphone?
Oh, yeah, you sound fine, dear. Thank you.
Okay. Assad is Alawite, and it is. I know that they're a smaller group in Syria, but I think Mr. Campbell is right. One of the reasons a lot of international forces, NATO and United States, are very hesitant right now to get involved too much because we don't really know who are the rebels exactly. I think there are a lot of factions, and we just want to make sure we're not supporting Al-Qaeda, for example, by mistake, which we, you know, we didn't, they turn into Al-Qaeda and Taliban, you know, what happened with Reagan supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against Soviets. And so, I think we need to be really careful and sensitive before we get deeply involved in these conflicts because, as we see, it turns around to really bite us in our behinds. And that's one of the reasons I am understanding or I'm thinking the hesitancy of the administration not get involved too much.
Thank you very much. Tufik, any comments about the Alawites?
Well, I concur with Dennis. They've been a minority group for a long time. And that's, you know, as far as I know, they've always been... let me rephrase that. Until the 70s, early 70s, they were marginalized in society. And there's even some... There's a restaurant in Broward County, Rick, that I went to. It's an Arab restaurant. And there's these... You know, I don't want to give them a religious label, but they are some...
Sure.
Uh-huh. And we were discussing about the Syrian conflict a month ago, and the owner and another person was telling myself, no, Alawites are not Muslim. Alawites are not Muslim. They're heretics, this and that. And I did not want to argue because it's
sure.
not my battle.
Yeah.
But I just felt it was a ridiculous argument. There are some people who feel that the Shiite Muslims are not the real ones. And so it's not my battle, but there's people in the opposition who said that against Alawites. And Alawites are fearful of the sentiments. Not of all. Let me rephrase, not all Sunni, but there's a minority that adhere to that point of view about Alawites.
Well, you've got the same. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, Rick. The issue that that keeps coming up, and it's one in which we'll continue to struggle with, is until a group exerts a level of control or is on the verge of forming a government and becoming a leadership organization, you have this dilemma of whom do you arm and whom do you support in that region because. As we've seen time and again across that region, you could very well be, you know, helping to build the next Mujahideen group in Afghanistan and not even know it. I mean, it's very easy for the members of the Republican Party to stand on the side and say, you know, the U.S. is doing nothing. I think that's an exaggeration because what do you want to do in that situation? Do you want to go about arming somebody? I mean, for example, when Libya fell, thousands upon thousands of guns and mortars and RPGs disappeared into the night, and nobody knows where those weapons are. Syria has an enormous cache of chemical weapons that the government claims are under their control, but you don't know where they are at this point. And if you, you know, inadvertently help one group, you could be unleashing a terror across the region that you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen.
Excellent. Thank you. The next question I want to ask, and this is not, again, I'm not going to ask any of you fine people any easy questions, so I'm asking you some toughies because you, I think, have some unique insight. Let me ask you this. Saudi Arabia. Now, here you've got a nation that is so wealthy that they can easily invest in all kinds of motions, all kinds of movements, support all kinds of governments, armaments, etc. Are they a force for good? Or is that too simplistic a way of putting it? Let's look just for a second at the Saudi Arabian influence across the Middle East. Who wants it?
Rick?
Yeah.
Hello, Rick?
Yes, go ahead, Tufik.
Okay. I would say they're not. And it's not because of the Syrian conflict. One can start from the Egyptian revolution. Where the Saudi king and their imams and all these lousy imams would denounce the Egyptians who are Muslim for protesting against the regime. And these are, you know, middle class, lower class Egyptian Muslims who wanted to fight against Mubarak, protest. And so they opposed the Egyptian and the Tunisian revolution. And then now Syria and not just Syria, in Lebanon too, they have, you know, they give money to all these groups, and they can be a destabilizer in the region, politically speaking, even economically. You know, but that's up to debate. That's a different topic. But. But just start with the Egyptian revolution. I was shocked when, you know, how could one denounce another group of Arabs who are the same faith and denounce them against fighting for their human rights, their civil rights.
Thank you. Emily?
I agree with Tafik, actually, because so don't forget Saudis are Wahhabis, which are really the most extremist form of Islam. And if anyone is going to get involved, we don't want them. They wouldn't want their Saudis' influence in the region. And I think maybe we also need to understand, again, it comes back to my point about each country being different, even though some of them are Arabs, some of them are not Muslim countries. They all have their own interests, you know, national interests. So I think the best thing to do is to let the people of each nation and country handle their own affairs until they ask for help. And even when they ask for help, just like it happened in Libya, bilateral intervention is never a good solution. It's been an international effort, and supporting the most secular, groups. I hope that's my wish, of course.
Thank you so much, Mahmoud.
Definitely, I agree with everything she said about each country has her own vision, and the meaning of as you know, it's kind of it's a game. It's a politic game. So everybody plays a game with his own rule, with his own interest. So it's kind of you don't know exactly what is this for and what kind of effect on this matter or in this issue. It's just like I can see it from my perspective, and they have their own goals, and definitely I can't figure out what they're thinking of. And I don't live there, so basically you don't know what the people in the street talk about that subject or how they handle their life on a daily basis with the government, with all these decisions they're making. So basically it's very hard to catch a certain aim or goal or a subject exactly, you will be sure, I know for 100% they said that because of this and this and that. That's how I see it.
Thank you. Thank you. Dennis?
Well, I think the only thing I can add is basically to mirror what has been said by others. The Saudi government cares only about one thing, and that's maintaining the relevance and safety of the House of Saud. So as long as you understand that, you understand basically how they're going to approach any issue.
Okay. Let me ask another issue. I mean, I realize I've got some very intelligent thinking people here, I compliment you that because I share so many of your values, all of you. Let me ask you this. This is another tough question. The value of respect for another religion. Almost all religions teach it to some extent. How it's practiced is obviously interpreted human to human. But the value of respect for religion, or the value for the individual's ability to interpret religion, you know, we constantly see people being charged with blasphemy, whether it be a child, whether it be for a variety of reasons. Do you think there's room in these Middle Eastern cultures, the ones that you're closest to, for an appreciation for a variety of interpretations of religion? And do you think it does exist? It just does exist in a spotty condition. Go ahead, Emily. Go ahead. You go first.
Well, I think what we can get back to what Mr. Campbell was saying. It took the United States about 11 years to get our constitution signed and got it together. These are countries, I mean, you need to understand, like he said, they were colonized over 100 years, and before that by my ancestors, the Ottomans. So it will take time, and we need to understand that poverty and illiteracy, it is whenever there's extreme poverty and illiteracy and oppression and dictatorships, it is easier to influence the people in large groups towards more conservative, more religious values. So it will take time, but I have a lot of hope. I see that people, especially younger generations, they're understanding, and they see, especially with the invention of internet, Facebook, these instant communication with the world, they understand, and they're going to get there, but it will take time, so, and we need to understand that too, and we can't impose our values on other people as well. We need to understand that too. So that's my take, but I think they will get there. It's just that's their struggle throughout between getting rid of their dictators and their poverty and illiteracy towards democracy and freedom, and, you know, that's where they are.
Thank you. Mahmoud?
Definitely it will take time because they're still thinking of the same ways like 50, 100 years ago. From my perspective, I believe that each religion should respect the other religion. I believe that, like, if I'm practice Christianity or Islamic or any kind of religion, I should treat the other person as a person, not because of his religion. His religion is something between him and his God. The way he's practicing, it's also very private. So it shouldn't be the way of religion affect my decision or how I can judge other people. I should judge other people as the kind of they are a human being and how kind these people are, how nice, how can I communicate with them on what level. But I shouldn't look at the people by the religion. He's a Christian, or he's a Muslim, or he's other religion. It doesn't matter as far as the value in the human being, not in his religion, because, as I said, it's kind of private between him or her and her God and or his God.
Thank you, Dennis.
Rick.
Oh, go ahead, Tufi. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I know we're focusing on Islam right now, but it's also in Arab Christianity where there is opposition to books that so-called denounce the Bible, such as the Da Vinci Code. It was banned in Lebanon a few years ago by the Maronite Church, which is the largest Catholic, Eastern Catholic Church in Lebanon. In addition, there was also a book, if I remember, I forgot which book it was, that was banned because the Coptics in Egypt wanted it banned. So, you know, there people think, oh, you know, blasphemy is only, Islam has a conflict with that. But it's not just Islam, it's Arab Christianity. It's not just in the Arab world, it's also in Europe where about 5-6 years ago, if I remember correctly, a cartoonist wrote a kind of a satire of the King of Spain, and he was fined by the courts for criticizing the king, if I remember correctly. I just shared the article with you. So
sure.
It's not just, you know, the Arab world that has issues,
of
but
course.
Different societies in different countries.
Thank you. Dennis?
I see two issues here. One is the issue of religion, and then the other is the issue of press freedoms. Speaking specifically to the issue of religion, there is a heightened sensitivity worldwide towards anybody who criticizes a religion. I'm running into that firsthand with an ebook I've created for the current presidential campaign on Mitt Romney and his Mormon faith. Now, I don't necessarily go after his faith, but what I do is I start to ask very specific questions about whether or not a religious leader, a leader in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, should be in the highest secular position in the United States, that of President of the United States. And in the course of that book, I discuss that. But the title is a rather humorous one, and in so doing, I get probably as many complaints about that from people who say you shouldn't be attacking someone's religion, so it's still a white-hot subject.
Oh, please, tell our audience the name of your book.
Magic Underwear in the Situation Room. And,
I like it.
it fits in line with the other books which had to do with the war on women, which I called The Vagina Wars and The Vagina Wars on Steroids. So I'm a frustrated headline writer more than anything else. But, you know, that said, we are talking an issue of freedom of speech and press freedoms. And a very good friend of mine, a professor who's from now with the University of Georgia, or Georgia State University, Matt Duffy, was part of the Zayed University in Dubai, and he was kicked out of the country quite unceremoniously because he was doing an awful lot to urge the government of Dubai and the United Arab Emirates to do more to ensure that there was more freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And I say this because this is a huge issue. If you look back to the uprising in Tahrir Square, you will see that the press were literally targeted. Members of the media were beaten. Many were killed. And it was a situation where there was a deliberate attempt by governments to make sure that any message about uprising is not allowed out of the country. A number of journalists have been killed covering the Syrian conflict, and I believe the number is about five times what it was the previous year of reporters doing their jobs that are actually being grievously harmed or indeed tortured and killed as a result of trying to get the story out. So when you mix this white-hot religious fervor with a desire by governments to maintain control over message and messaging and their brutal attacks on the media, those create the environment you were talking of, Rick.
Okay. I've got one more issue that I want to see your fine minds wrestle with just for a moment. we have heard nothing in this country but the beating of drums for war with Iran for many months now. And we've heard all kinds of threats from our ally Israel and many of the neocons, certainly with John Bolton on Team Romney. That doesn't bode well for peace. But let me ask you this. You know, the big excuse for war with Iran is that it's going to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons. Because, so the reasoning goes, and I think it's fallacious, so the reasoning goes, because if they get nuclear weapons, then Saudi Arabia is going to want nuclear weapons, and once Saudi Arabia gets nuclear weapons, everybody's going to want nuclear weapons. And that, to me, seems like a completely bogus argument, because that one country is not going to turn the key to let rampant proliferation go on in the Middle East. Obviously, there's plenty of reasons to worry about it. Let me ask you this. When we think about proliferation of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, do you see the Iraq situation as a linchpin? Do you see that as a reason to go to war? And let me start with you, Tufik.
No. I think the war by Prime Minister Netanyahu is just trying to deflect the attention from the Palestinian conflict, and he's been saying this, and other prime ministers of Israel have been saying this about Iran, that Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon within 3 years. And that happened in the 1990s. And then in the early 2000s. And then they talked about Iraq. And then Iraq is going to get a nuclear bomb. And you know what happened with that issue. So it's just they're trying to deflect the Palestinian issue and make people focus on Iran. Because if you get more people focused on Iran, then people will correlate Iran with the Palestinians, and they'll focus on that, because Iran is going to send nuclear bombs to the United States, just like Iraq was supposed to send Scud missiles to the United States, and that never happened.
Thank you.
So it's a joke.
Thank you, Emily.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I find the entire thing is very disingenuous because when we think about nuclear weapons, Pakistan has them, and
right.
How come we allow them to get it? So I think we need to be very careful when we know what happened with Valerie Plame's husband and what happened
right.
to her when her husband found out that there was no residue for any weapon makery in Iraq, that she was actually outed by the Bush administration. So for me, nobody should have nuclear arms. If it was up to me, everyone needs to get rid of their nuclear weapons. But when you think that, of course, Israel never confirmed that they have nuclear weapons, but it is supposed, I guess we assume they have. United States has them, we use them. So to think, I don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, I don't want any other country to have nuclear weapons, but I think it should be an international effort to work with them, and I just don't believe that we cannot afford another war. We just cannot afford another war right now. Our country, we borrowed money to wage two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. The interest on those wars are over $1.3 billion annually, I think. We're paying something interest on that borrowed money to wage those wars. And our budget for education is about $90 billion. Compare that to the interest that we're paying on wars. I mean, we need to stop making wars and find better options. If we really want to get rid of dictators, Bin Laden. We got Bin Laden with, 32 SEAL team, 32 people SEAL team. How much money we spend on that? A few million dollars. We really need to start thinking about smart wars. We need to be more smart when it comes to warring and conflict than go in and send 300,000 soldiers and spend trillions of dollars on it. Put our economy in risk. So I don't agree with it at all. I hope we need to do anything to prevent it.
Thank you. Maud?
Nuclear disarmament from the Middle East is one of the major and important things to happen. But if you look at the situation, you're going to find out that, like, Israel has a nuclear weapon, and it's only the country on the Middle East has a nuclear weapons. On the other hand, a lot of Arabic countries trying to get nuclear, not weapons, but just use it for electricity, because as I understand, back in my country, they've been trying to make a lot of thoughts between Egypt and Russia to how to invent all these nuclear, to invent power and electricity, because we really need it so bad. And but I don't know what happened after that, but it seems like everybody trying to get the nuclear power or nuclear weapon. So basically, I wish it's going to be this area, all the Middle East, disarmed from the clear nuclear weapon. But it seems like we're going to have a problem after problem after problem. It started with Iraq 12 years ago, and now is Iran, and I don't know who's next. But seems like it's like it's running from country like in. From country to another, so I don't think like anybody can stop them, and the only thing to stop them to like to happen what's happened like in Iraq, and I don't think the world is ready to make another war and war after that and war after that just to stop the countries from doing that. So it's really a strange situation, and you never know what's going to happen next.
Well, thank you, sir.
This is a thing.
Thank you. Dennis?
Well, you know, there's been a long-standing now series of sanctions against the Iranian regime. And there was an article this morning here in the UK in The Guardian by Harriet Sherwood, who is probably one of the best people we have on the ground here. And she's put out a couple of things here. First of all, the currency, the rial in Iran, is just about at the point of collapse. It fell another 5% over the weekend as an all-time low against the U.S. dollar, and it's fallen almost 57% since June of last year. So that's leading to a big internal price increase for goods. But most importantly, Israel's finance minister, Steinitz, said that the economy is not collapsing, but it is on the verge of collapse. They've lost a ton of oil revenue, 45 to 50 billion U.S. dollars. And by the end of the year, that's a huge amount of money. So they're in great economic difficulties. And it's beginning to look as though the sanctions are having a profound effect on the economy and could destabilize the government. And it hasn't persuaded them to abandon their nuclear program. But as sanctions are really beginning to kick in and take an effect, coupled with a lot of the rather strange things that have happened from the, you know, U.S. has admitted that they were behind the Stuxnet virus, which caused all the centrifuges to shut down, and the recent attack on the electrical supply going into their nuclear power plants. When I hear the GOP talk and say there's nothing being done, when I hear Romney on the campaign trail saying there's nothing being done, he's speaking from a point of complete ignorance. Because the one thing I have seen of President Obama and the efforts that he is doing is that nobody knows what's happening until it happens, and it's for a very damned good reason. You don't tip your hand if you're behind all of these things. If you're trying to collapse an economy, if you're trying to stop a program, you don't necessarily have to come in with a warship parked off of the coast, hurling in, you know, Scud missiles, missiles and other kinds of armament, if you can proceed to stop a program this way. And if you give this another 3 to 6 months, not only will they completely dismantle the program, you'll find yourself in a situation where the government will fall.
Well, thank you very much. That's some useful insight. One more question I want to ask, I think we have time to go around, is, you know, we've been in Afghanistan now for all these years, The plan was that we would, stand them up and then we'll walk away. Clearly, that's not working. In fact, we saw just recently them saying, look, we're giving up. It's not working. We are not succeeding. And in fact, we're seeing what they call blue on blue, or trainees, or seemingly trainees, turning on U.S. forces. Short of walking away, what do you see is the, quote, victory that our government needs to see so we can finally evacuate our troops from occupying Iraq and Afghanistan? Let me start with Emini.
Well, I thought our original intent was to get rid of al-Qaeda and find bin Laden. We got bin Laden, and basically al-Qaeda is almost dismantled because administration has been really capturing and killing the top officials of al-Qaeda. Last I heard, I think al-Qaeda was leaving Somalia. So administration is doing a pretty good job getting dismantling that organization. And as far as the Afghanistan, what we can say, I think we need to leave, just like, we did with the with Iraq. And but I remember that the president gave a time frame. He was talking about 2014. Romney said he doesn't even know when he just doesn't even have a policy on it. So I also want to mention one thing that I remember. I forgot to tell you about Iran and the war. What I learned happened in United States military, 65% of United States military is contracted to defense contractors right now, including mercenary armies, which are getting three times of the pay of our regular troops. So this is creating a lot of resentment and problems within the military itself. And one of those contractors was famous Blackwater. I don't know, you probably heard Blackwater.
Oh, sure.
Heard of it. The chairman of Blackwater, Kofor Black, who was the chairman of Blackwater during Bush administration, is in, right now, he is a national security advisor for Mr. Romney. So we can all presume and understand that if Romney becomes president, Iran war is definitely, we're definitely going to get into war with Iran. And we're going to stay in Afghanistan indefinitely. So I think this coming election is vital for our country's economy and security. We need to understand that and make our decisions accordingly.
Thank you. Dennis, Mahmoud?
When I see, when I look at it, I feel like it's like every time when you try to do something nice to the other countries and to helping in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and you're trying to solve problems and try to fix the whole world problems, the thing is just only from our perspective. But when from their perspective, they don't like it. They don't like the Americans to come over and occupy the country. And it will never be a victory, and it will never to get to that point like we got a victory, because every time we're going to do this or we're going to do that or we're going to help thousands of our soldiers killed in their countries, and we're just trying to help. And on the other hand, they don't look at it the same way. So it's like it's never going to be a victory at all.
Thank you. Dennis?
Well, we've just really spent way too much time, effort, and energy in that part of the world trying to bring people around to our way of thinking. And we really got to stop trying to force a worldview that comes from our own view on a group of people who are really just trying to find their own way. They need to be given the choice and the option across that region to find their way, and we need to stay out of the way and stop propping up puppet regimes and thinking that foreign aid and arms are all that are needed to keep the region under control. That bottle is open, the genie is completely out, and it's time for people now to really pay attention to what is it that our relationship is going to be with these nations going forward, no matter what.
Thank you. I want to thank you all for this wonderful exchange. You each brought a unique perspective, and I want to thank you so much on behalf of myself, on behalf of Mickey Royce, my co-producer. Dennis, I want to ask you to please give the names of your recent books.
The recent one that's just come out is also available in paperback because a number of people didn't have the Kindle or the capability. It's called The Billionaire Boys Election Freak Show, and it's a nice compilation of the four e-books that have been produced since February over the course of this campaign. And as I say, it's available for sale now on Amazon and hopefully in other sources very, very soon.
Also, your books on Tahrir?
Yeah, the one book that I have is something that was written shortly after the revolution, and it's called Egypt Unshackled. And that was all about the 18 days of the Tahrir Square Uprising. That book is going through a revision right now in which we're adding two or three chapters that show what's happened since then. And that should be available right after the election. So it's probably around about the 15th of November or so.
Thank you. And Emine, what are you working on right now?
Well, I don't know if you're aware that we have a Facebook group over close to 60,000 followers, members we have. I wanted to mention that one, that we post daily news and information about United States and, domestic politics, but also from around the world. So that one is called Pragmatic Progressive page. So anyone is interested, they can just, check us out on Facebook. We are also a group of liberal-minded French journalists, and we're working on a new project, which is going to be another online news journal. It's called progressivepress.net. That's going to be launched within a month. So I wanted to mention these two projects.
Well, best of luck with both of those.
I didn't realize you were pragmatic progressive. Nice to meet you.
Yes, please. You can definitely post your information to our page, by the way. Anything about your books, anything else, so I'll make sure to mention to our members.
Thank you so much.
And Mahmoud, what are you working on these days?
Working as a graphic designer, and it's been fantastic and beautiful dealing with art and design, colors, lions. It's so awesome, and I'm trying to keep it that way.
Well, thank you all one more time. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
And I'm gonna end on a couple news notes. So thanks again, and you all have a good night.
You too, Rick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, these two news items I do want to cover before the show is out. On October 2nd in Boca Raton, Oceania, we'll be conducting a mock seismic air gun test at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. And they're calling on U.S. government to take action and stop such testing in the Atlantic Ocean because of its impact on marine animals. So if you want more information, contact Rebecca Marks, Oceania organizer. And that's going to be Tuesday the 2nd, 11 a.m. to 12 noon, at the Free Speech Zone on FAU Boca Raton campus, 777 Glades Road. And also on the 27th of October at 6:15, Real Politique will be screening the Koch Brothers Exposed, Robert Greenwald's superb documentary. See how much influence you have if you had $50 billion. And there will also be performances by the Pink Slip Singers, musicians Joan Friedenberg and Bill Bowen. And the film begins at 7, followed by an informative discussion led by yours truly, Rick Spezak. We hope you join us. That's October 27th. And we'll talk to you next week. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much. And remember, it is a better world to come in, and we're the ones who are going to do it. Thanks so much for all the good work that you do.
There's a better world to come in, tell you why. There's a better world to come in, tell you why. We will see them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come in, tell you why. There's a better world to come in, don't you see. There's a better world.
Hope you tune in next week. We'll see you then.
All be free. There's a better world to come in, don't you see? There's a better world to come in, don't you see?
you know, no, no, there's a better world to come in, don't you know? I'm a union man in the union war, it's a union world I'm fighting for, there's a better world to come in, don't you know? There's a better world to come, there's a better world to come, there's a better world to come, and I'll tell you why.
Is it off? Is it gone?
Yep, it's gone, sir. Hey, thanks so much, my friend. Thank you so much.
Oh, that was fun. Yeah. I was interested to see how it actually worked with Blog Talk Radio, so that's why I hung on, because so they time you out, that's all you get, is that time count?
Yeah, well, in addition to the audio, there's a little display element that shows it, and I keep three clocks live in my studio so I can, no matter where I look, I can see what time it is, because I'm typically looking from one document to something on the screen to something over here, and it keeps me somewhat sane. I used to run a TV station, so I'm accustomed to doing this with, you know, a couple different people. So doing it all on your own is a little stimulating.
Is Mickey there with you?
No. She's basically monitoring from another location from her house. And if I get into trouble or I text her, if something's going awry, maybe a guest doesn't show up or something. And I always try to keep a couple clips of other material. For example, I have an interview I did with an Iraqi who was a former student of mine, that if somebody didn't show up, I could just plug that in.
Right.
And,
right.
So it's a thrill a minute.
No, bad it is.
Well, sir,
right.
Well, it's
1:30 in the morning, so I'm going to call it a night.
Okay. Take care, Dennis.
Back again soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.